And thanks for assembling a group of people from this range of interests. And my talk today is going to be coming in a lot of ways from the opposite direction to the talks we heard yesterday. That is, as someone who sort of is a practitioner, is a grammar writer and a grammar reader of always book grammars so far, which were not written with any conscious notion of hypertext in mind. As a grammar writer and field worker, I'm more at, if you look at this little graphic of the weaving, I'm more at the unwoven outer edge. And I think as you work on little-known languages, you often have to be free to come up with solutions that aren't necessarily computationally very kosher. But on the other hand, when you present these, ultimately you have to move some of them back into a tighter weave. So I'm going to work by induction from existing book grammars, most of which, as I've said, have not been written with any developed theory of hypertext in mind. There are some exceptions. I'll put them up here now before ignoring them for the rest of the talk. So these are three recent and very interesting attempts to transcend the constraints of the book. So this book by Nick Tieberger, which is published here in Hawaii and was submitted at University of Melbourne, and it deals with hypertext at the level of the nexus between example sentences and a textual corpus. So you can, those of you who haven't looked at this, I heartily recommend it. You can click in the electronic version that accompanies the book and get there into the examples in the corpus, and Nick developed this interesting software called Ariamus allowing you to do this. And then Stephen Moore is one on the right, which was submitted at Monash University, and at the time he submitted it, he had to fight a long battle with the university authorities to be able to include all of this material. So I hope these battles are becoming less and less necessary, but they still do exist in areas. So this was published with Pacific Linguistics, and again has a very rich nexus with actual material. But I would say that that hypertext in these is really restricted to the relation of example to data. And then our Nobel organizer, Sebastian Nordhoff, his very interesting grammar of Sri Lankan Malay, which you can look at online, and that has taken applications of hypertext further than these other ones in terms of organization. So these are, as I've said, things which I'm mentioning because they're all recent and interesting attempts to grapple with this, but I'm going to be looking now at a much sort of older tradition. And the reason for this is I think that it's ironic, you know, we study languages which are fragile and which represent oral traditions whose fragility we're all too aware of. But the literary tradition in our own culture is also fragile. That is, books can just stop being read. Grammars especially. They're complicated, forbidding, 600 or 1,000 pages long, and it's very easy for people just to stop going back or just to dip in. And I think immersing yourselves in this, you can learn a lot. So this talk is basically inductive. Maybe in Jeff's terms, you would say it was reactive. It's drawing on existing grammars by a range of authors. And I'm going to organize this by function. That is, I'm not going to be talking about it from a computational point of view, how you would implement this. That's another whole interesting question. But rather, what are the functions of hypertext in the grammars? And many of these have been mentioned by other presenters. Some of them haven't been. So let's just go back to the beginning of it all. That is the Paninian ideal, which you still hear people say is the greatest grammar ever written, and certainly this is something that was said a lot in the 60s and 70s by Kiparsky and others. And if we ask how much hypertext is in the Arstadhyayi, the answer is not much, actually, depending how you define it. So you have initial meta-rules and definitions. You could say that there's sort of implicit hypertextual links between those to every instantiation of the terms, but you could also say it uses the linear format to not need hypertext for that. Then you have very compact rules, which are sort of compression algorithms in some way, and you have rules that are order sensitive, so reverse the order that we write rules in nowadays, giving the elsewhere almost general conditions first and then giving the particular ones. So we know that this is still held to be the most explicit and comprehensive account of a language, but what does it lack? It doesn't have example sentences, doesn't have discussion of the arguments, reasons for framing a particular analysis, no reference to other languages or terminologies. Well, he was lucky. He was the first guy to be writing these things, so he didn't have to... whatever terminology he invented, that was it, right? Whereas now, if you write a grammar of a language and you use the word subject, you've got 4,000 or 5,000 other grammars that have already used it, and you have to position yourself with respect to that somewhere. So anyway, it's just helpful to remind ourselves of this, because if we think about what's changed in grammar writing, in many ways, actually people have retreated from the Paninian ideal, that is, away from compactness that gets realised in other aspects of research, and away from this very spare style which human beings were capable of memorising and transmitting orally from one generation to another, which is, you know, held to be one of the reasons why it was so compact. So we then have a movement of what we could say an implicit growth in hypertext in book format. Hypertext has been creeping in for all sorts of reasons, and if I once asked Paul Kipaski how he'd learned Sanskrit, and he said that he basically started reading through the Ashtadhyayi with the commentaries. And I think if he'd just read the Ashtadhyayi, he wouldn't have learned it. You have to go out to the commentaries, which were the hypertext written somewhere else relating back to it. Now, Jeff wrote a very important article in 2004 surveying four grammars, including, you know, Martin Haspelmath's really beautiful grammar of Lesghian, and then two Bantu grammars, and then this one by Williamson on Ijaw. And he pointed out that they all have at least the following four characteristics, that you have some basic structure consisting of a series of sections, possibly nested. You have descriptive prose in the sections. You've got exemplars of grammatical phenomena through the sections, and you have ontologies throughout, implicit or otherwise. So these are all in some way pointing in this direction of increasing hypertext. But I'm wanting to talk about lots of other functions. So basically, in preparing this talk, I went back to a lot of my old favourite grammars and read some others as well, and just jotted down every time I thought, oh yeah, well this is actually really hypertext. With the goal of pulling out what these things are so that we can not leave things out when we, in the future, design these in a more explicit and forward-looking way. So let's think about evidence and data. Well, my friends Nick Tieberger and Simon Musgrave couldn't make it due to floods in Melbourne. I'm actually slightly grateful because I'd put something about Nungabuyu in there and I was worried I was going to overlap with them. So I hope at least... this part of their talk will make it through. So this is from Geoffrey Heath's Functional Grammar of Nungabuyu, published in 1984. Must be one of the most visually unappealing grammars ever written, but it's one of the greatest. And its sort of impact really comes from its determined use to root every claim in a very large corpus of Nungabuyu texts, which he published before the grammar. And in the preface to this 1984 grammar, he says that he'd started off writing something based on, you know, more traditional methods, and then he decided he wasn't going to put anything in there that wasn't already in the text collection, and he deliberately didn't publish this until the text collection was out. So the evidence upon which he based it, you know, was there for all to see. So this is one example. I think I'll go on to the next one, which is even more extreme. This is some of the limpid prose of the Nungabuyu grammar. The examples are budge with non-predicative nouns, other place names are 28.16.2, 43.15.8, on it goes, I won't read it all out to you, and then examples with unharden, waj, yaj, or aj are 13.1, and so on. You can see it's not, you know, an aesthetic experience reading grammars like this. What he was struggling with, wanting to do what we could do much more easily now, that is, found every statement in pointers to an actual text collection And I'm assuming that Nick and Simon were going to say, yeah, hey, we've worked out how to implement this. I don't know if that's what they were going to say, but it's what needs to be done and would do justice to Heath's conception of the grammar he was writing. So this is an extreme case of what I think any good grammar does, that is to point to examples from actual usage, and in this case from a finite corpus, that is, he transcribed, translated, analysed a subset of the material he recorded, and his grammar was accountable to that subset. I think there's a bit of a problem with writing a grammar where you're working on a language and you've analysed some of the corpus and not all of it. I think we have to have a sort of Russian doll model, that we have a sort of high-quality curated corpus that we're basing our statements on, and then we're inviting readers to go out and apply them to a larger corpus that maybe hasn't been fully analysed yet. So let's just think about this issue of example elaboration, which is maybe the most obvious type of hypertext. That's what's there in the Tiburger and Mori grammars. So minimally, you will have a sentence in your text which is exemplifying some point. Slightly elaborated, it might have a paired phonemicization and meaning, although that's not always the case. In grammars of better-known languages, like, say, grammar of Spanish or something, you'll just cite the sentence without anything else. And since 1909, according to Ulrike Mosel, this was the first person to use glossing, Josef Meyer, in his collection of myths and tales from the Gazelle Peninsula in New Guinea, we've begun to use glossing. That actually crept into linguistic practice rather slowly. So if you look at Bob Dixon's Dirbal grammar, written in 1972, which for many of us Australianists was the sort of the flashing light that showed us what a grammar could really do, that doesn't give interlinear glosses. It was only in this 1977 grammar of Yidin that he did it. And I think nowadays you wouldn't publish a grammar without doing it, but it's still rather recent and extremely under-theorised. Christian has written about this, a very important article, but most of the analytic action is actually there in the glosses, in the grammar, and yet most people who teach linguistics don't even have a single hour of talk in their 3 hours, 3 years of undergraduate on what goes into glossing. So it's very important, and let's look at some of the issues very briefly. So I'll just give you a little example from Nen here. There's an immediate question: do you have a one-size-fits-all gloss, that is, that you just use glosses all the way through, so it's a sort of invariant representation of morphological structures, or do you see glosses as a pedagogical device that help the reader to understand the example at hand? And I think there are reasons to adopt both positions, actually. So if we just look at a single Nen word, so this is a language in southern New Guinea I've begun working on recently. If I say the Nen word, Iwingbundit, I could gloss it in the top way, right? So reflecting the ambiguities of interpretation of every morpheme as faithfully as I can. So saying this word could mean all of the following things. So the Yil prefix can either be second person non-singular undergo or third person. And the T suffix at the end could be second or could be third person. And the Nd suffix could this be general perfective, or it could be more specifically current. Now, which gloss you give depends on broader context, actually. So the perfective as opposed to the current reading, as soon as you look at the series of the first prefix, you know it has to be the current reading. So in a more constructional context, you would say that, but if you say this is just for the gloss, you would give the more general reading. And with the second versus third person, they're not always homophonous. Sometimes they are, sometimes they're not. As soon as you put in a free pronoun, you disambiguate. So if you're a reader going through and then text, do you really want to have to be told every time it could have been this, could have been that? Have bigger glosses. That's faithful to the informational content of each morpheme considered individually. Or do you just want to say, oh yeah, okay, that's how you got that reading, and select something to a broader context. So I assume that one advantage of hypertext grammars in the future is you'll be able to check and say, well, okay, I want one or the other according to my present purpose as a grammar reader. And in discussing the morphology, you might want to have one solution, that part of the grammar. In discussing the syntax, you might want to have another solution. That's what I would probably adopt as a solution writing a book, but you might also want to have a solution that gives both options there. Now, paradigms are an interesting type. So in NEN, there's over 1,700 inflected verbs, forms of a single transitive verb. It's probably not possible, at least within my limits of my mind, to put those all into one table without using several dimensions, which are hard to put in a book. However, you can sort of break the problem down into parts and treat the suffix variation independently from the prefix variation. So this little sub-paradigm here, I've put in just for illustrating the suffix paradigm or part of it. One thing about this is, if we're really going to be kosher in relating this to data, we should have a linked sound file and a sentence example for each thing. Heath himself disobeyed his own rule of giving textual evidence for everything when it came to paradigms. And I think if you imagine, say, a 1700 item paradigm for each verb in a language like NEN, and then you think, well, there's lots of verbs, lots of different conjugation classes and so on, how big would a naturalistic sample need to be before I witnessed all of those? It would probably have to be much bigger than any currently conceived field campaign would show up. Anyway, this is an example of the suffixes. And then, in fact, to get the whole deal, for each one of the cells in this paradigm, you can then instantiate it with respect to its prefix or variation. So I've just taken one of the cells, the one yijie, and now I've started varying the prefixes, which are the undergoer prefixes, and there's an alpha series for tense starting from last night, basically, and a beta series for tense a few days ago, and we can go through all of those and put paradigms. So there's an issue of how to present these complex paradigms. Book forms don't do it very well. Multi-dimensional displays would do it better, but there's also this issue of probably giving an example sentence for each one. So taking that form UGA, you could give a sentence for that. I've never read a grammar where every cell in a large paradigm is linked to an example sentence. It would be, you know, paralyzingly dull reading, but we need to have it if we really want to show that we've got it right. I mean, it's very easy to go wrong in such complex morphology. Now, another thing about glosses is, are these encompassing translations of a sentence or of an utterance? That is, you, as a field linguist, you normally get given a translation. It's usually a translation in context. But grammars aren't just about contextualized sentences, they're about what they could mean. So I think that giving context is really important. That's not necessarily part of the translation, but part of the framing of the utterance that you have recorded. So let's look at the one from Anton Guillaume's Cavinegna grammar. So he gives some very interesting things about the exact date of the event described by the sentence and the date on which he recorded it, which is relevant to asking about the precise meaning of tense, as an example. And it's also very important to give alternatives. So alternative transcriptions, maybe one phonetic, one orthographic, or maybe you're not sure of the right transcription. Maybe glossing that another author has given, maybe another author has given it another way, or you're not sure. There could be two parsings, different readings, commentaries on alternatives, different translations, so an utterance versus a sentence meaning, speaker's translation versus a linguist's translation, and so on. So Tamsin Donaldson's beautifully sensitive grammar of Ngamba, which I recommend to all of you, is really a good example of this. A lot of sentences she will give two translations for and say, well, you could actually do it one way or the other. And again and again, she does this. Sometimes it's based on alternative readings of a sentence in different contexts. Sometimes it's a way of presenting what's happening in two different ways that illustrates it. So, you know, a really artful presentation of examples will go down to this level and often give literal meanings as well. So let's just give an example of Kaidult from these two. So this was from a humorous song that some woman was singing to her very ugly suitor, And she said to him, right? So literally, see how ugly you are compared to beautiful me. Like, how could you have a hope with me, right? But it comes out as, you know, see your ugly self beside beautiful me. So this tension between, you know, a literal translation and something which conveys the meaning better is often there. I think just for reasons of time, I'll skip along a little bit. So multiple paths in hypertext are obviously important. Traditional grammars are linear, and if you're Sebastian, then even hypertext grammars will remain linear here. I guess we've got two Sebastians. It's not helpful. Sebastian Druda, I mean. So if you have non-linear elements, like tables of contents, Martin Haspelmath's use of indexes in his Lesghian Grammar is very interesting because he includes index references to non-existing elements in the language. So if you went looking for something that wasn't there, it would just be listed in the index. So I can't remember if he has an asterisk or something like that to say, I didn't leave it out because I was a bad linguist. I left it out because it's not there in the language. Tables of cross-references, footnotes, small print asides, like this one from Tamsin Donaldson's Gamba Grammar again. These are all sort of implicit uses of hypertext at the next level. There's what we might call inquiry orientation. So we know, we heard yesterday in Christian's talk, that there's a conflict between form-based and meaning-based expositions. Even though grammars are not always consistent, they tend to be predominantly form-based. And most grammar users, for example, typologists, are usually wanting meaning-based expositions. So typological questionnaires, which will, you know, say, how do you do necessity in this language, or how do you deal with tense or quoted speech or whatever, it's often quite hard to find your way in, even with a good table of contents and index. So hypertext grammars obviously offer us a way of doing this, although there are sort of pre-structured ways where you've already thought about certain questions, and what's going to be the case, of course, is that there will be future questions you haven't thought about, so how to make it available to those future questions. Pedagogical orientation, again, we heard about this a little bit yesterday. I think it's very hard to read a grammar from cover to cover, because if a grammar's complete, it will say more than you initially want to know. It will give you every subconjugation and irregularity, and what you really want to do is start off getting what happens with a regular verb, gradually digest that, and then go back a few weeks later, fortified with something appropriate, and start looking at the irregularities. So grammars that might make it possible to sort of spiral in successive levels of detail would be very valuable. And likewise, grammars that cater to different types of reader interests. Just keep going on now. So what I call the Rubik effect in grammars, that is, when you write a grammar, everything has to hang together. And it means that a lot of the argumentation will be distributed. So, for example, you might give arguments about the status of a particular phonemic segment. Is it a semi-vowel, a vowel, or a rhotic? And that might appear in several places in your phonology section. Once in the phonemic inventory, once in the phonotactics, once on morphophonemic alternations. They belong in those places, but you also want to bring together those arguments in some way. Or, for example, you might bring together the arguments for particular grammatical relations. What are the tests for subjects? What are the tests for objects? And they will be discussed in different parts of the grammar. One might belong in a subordinate clause section. One might belong in verb agreement and so on. Then you have to deal with what we can call multiple layers. We might have glossic layers, as we can call them. So when I wrote my grammar of Binnen Gunwok, that dealt with a pan-dialectal grammar. There's 3, 4, 5 dialects. I found it very interesting to deal with them together. There were lots of reasons, including the opportunistic ones, that I couldn't always work with speakers of the same dialect on the same questions. But also, I thought this was modelling what's actually happening in the speech community. People position themselves inside a variable speech community. But then some, let's say, linguistically puristic readers might want to say, I just want to know about Miley. I don't want to know about Gune or Gunwingu. That's my language. I just want to know this. So can you just lift out one glossic layer? And you might make comparisons with closely related languages. So this very nice Grammar of Spanish by Button Benjamin, every now and then it lapses into little comparative remarks about how Spanish differs from French or Italian or Portuguese in particular ways. Then there are what we can call chronic layers. So synchronic versus diachronic statements of particular phenomena. Definitions we've already talked about yesterday, so I'll just go through this quickly. That is, you face the conflict between language internal definitions of, say, subject or semi-vowel or whatever. Lucky Bunny only had to do that. But we have to always place ourselves, and unless we're just going to use totally arbitrary labels like morpheme number 315A, then we will have to deal with baggage for every term we use. And I think the only real solution is that we should feel free to make sensible definitions that fit a language, but at the same time know that they deviate from cross-linguistic uses in some regards. So dealing with nen, there's a set of prefixes that I'm calling undergoer prefixes. They can be intransitive subjects, they can be objects, they can be indirect objects. It's not a great term, but I haven't found a better one. Maybe someone will come up after and give one to me, but it's just a problem, right? That they are that set, and whatever term you use, unless you create one more neologism in the field, is going to conflict with some existing uses. So ultimately, maybe we'll dream of having something like this ISOCAT database or a gold ontology or some ontology of terms that we can link to, but at the moment that's very much different people referring to different standards actually for what terms should do. Inclusion criteria. So you say, how many cases does a language have? Well, you look at another layman, Thomas Lehmann's Grammar of Tamil. He answers this question and he says, well, it depends what you mean by case. Different people have said different things. So he has a section on that general question and then four pages on exactly which suffixes count as the genitive case in Tamil. These are argumentative questions that a grammar needs to do, especially when it's situating itself inside an existing tradition. Or you want to say, does the language have tone? Well, depends what you mean by tone. Maybe it's pitch accent. What do you mean by pitch accent? You have to have these inclusion criteria that you give and that actually sharpen the analysis often by making explicit what the features are. And operational criteria in a language. So in Bidingunwak, there's several sorts of noun incorporation, body part incorporation, generic incorporation, secondary predicate incorporation. If I'm to use those terms as an author, I have to give my operational criteria for saying, you know, it's a case of body part incorporation because it does the following things. So these will be there in a good grammar, and they are part of hypertext as well. I'll just keep going. Representations. These are very useful. What's their role in a grammar? They're not actually rules. That is, maybe if you actually do a sort of Panini style where you have a complete set of rules and you've defined them all, then they would be. But in most grammars, they are there as expository devices rather than as part of the explanation. And you say, well, this helps us understand what's going on, in this case, in fixation, in simile, in Nicole Crusp's grammar. But in a way, it's a hop out of the description. She's already described it, but she says, it'll help you see what's going on if you do this. Thanks. Nearly there. Another feature of good grammars is alternative arguments. That is, often there's more than one way to see things. And at the moment, there's a sort of regulation by taste. You don't want to do this for everything, or the grammar will come across as very indecisive and hard to follow. But there are key points where it's just hard to tell. And you go into the consideration of a couple of different analytic possibilities. So this is another sort of hypertext where you're saying, well, this is one analysis, here's another one. There's also what we can call evolving discourse. That is, other published claims about the language. So-and-so said this language doesn't have a grammatical subject. I'm saying it does. This is why. Correction of prior claims that might be wrong. So Mark Dury's Achenese Grammar has a little jihad against Lawler's analysis of grammatical relations. reanalysis or commentary on other arguments or data. Say so-and-so, tin-eared linguist that they were, failed to hear the tone in this word, but here it is, listen to the sound file. Reconciliation with incompatible forms published elsewhere. So there might be data which is problematic for your account and you want to go on record saying how you resolve the problem one way or another, or saying, well, I said this in my previous published paper, now I know that there's this other thing, this is what my evidence is. And explanations. Can I just do more? Yeah. So diachronic explanations for irregularities. Rob Branken has a very interesting discussion, not in a grammar, but in a paper about a grammar, of how you can understand what verbs take ablaut in Suet from historical considerations. You can't get any synchronic account of why they're there. So sometimes, if you're thinking that a reader wants to know why and not just given a list, you have to do that. Functional explanations are saying, well, why do you block vowel coalescence just in this type of compound? Well, if you did, it would cause these problems and so on. Alec Koop has some nice examples of that in his grammar of Mong Senao. Or comments on seemingly perverse features of a language. So in Tamsin Donaldson's grammar, she talks about this suffix, which she glosses as name, and why you put it on proper names. And she says why it's useful to have that, and comments on nearby languages. Comments on what we can call the genius of a language that Peter mentioned yesterday in his comments on Jeff's paper. So as a grammarian, you feel that there are these structural design principles, architectural principles that run through a grammar, and somewhere you want to draw the reader's attention to those. It helps see the grammar as a whole. I'll skip that. Hypertext, so I'll just skip because I'm running out of time. Just the last thing before I tie up. In languages that have systematic lectal differences. So Binningunwak has so-called Gungoreng, which is like a respect variety, mother-in-law variety, where you replace lexical items but you keep grammatical morphemes the same. And treating those things in parallel, this is really getting two very closely related grammars for the price of one, because there are a couple of little differences. You want to be giving parallel treatments like this. So just to conclude, I think that hypertext is going to be more and more important. To really develop it to its full potential, we have to understand all the ways it's used in, the best grammars that we have written outside the hypertextual era. And I think in the context of language documentation, we have to orient it to language corpora. We already saw this yesterday. I think we have to have a better notion of different degrees of corpus that we're accountable to. I think it can help us more generally in the field to be more precise about what judgments are, what role negative evidence plays. So if we say you can't say X, where's the point in your corpus that demonstrates the impossible sentence? It'll typically be a discussion. You'll run it past a speaker and they say, no, you can't say that. But we want to know, why did the speaker say you couldn't say that? Maybe they just didn't like, having a woman spearing a fish or something, and maybe it wasn't ungrammatical. So it'll help linguists develop a theory of data, and potentially it will help open these things up to broad audiences. I'm not sure that we should be over-optimistic about that. I think there are a lot of problems, but potentially it's there. So again, as Jeff pointed out yesterday, technological innovations typically find new ways to deal with old problems, this retrofitting problem, then generate new problems of their own. And we know that we'll get a lot of new things that we can't even think about. But I also think it's important to have a very nuanced view of all the roles that hypertext can play in grammars that have been written over the last few decades. I know I haven't been complete today, but I've tried to give some notion of how many roles there are. Thank you.